This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, live from the headquarters of the National Geographic in Washington, D.C. On April 20th, a geyser of seawater, mud, and methane gas exploded out of the marine riser on the Deepwater Horizon offshore drilling platform and detonated. After 36 hours in flames, the platform sank to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 5,000 feet below. 11 men died on the rig, and for 87 days, oil and natural gas spewed out of the shattered well. The best estimate puts the total at 4.9 million barrels of crude oil and the equivalent of another 2 million barrels of natural gas, along with tons of chemical dispersants. They fouled the water, killed wildlife, soaked into coastal wetlands and tarred beaches. On land, livelihoods were lost. Communities tested by recession took hits they could not afford. Today, in partnership with National Geographic, we're broadcasting from their Washington headquarters. We want to hear what you want to know about the oil and what worries you about the impact on the environment. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We're also going to be taking questions from the audience here in the Grosvenor Auditorium. Joining me on stage is Joel Bourne, contributing writer for National Geographic magazine, author of the October issue's cover story, a special report on the spill and its aftermath, titled The Deep Dilemma. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
Also here on stage, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, always good to have you on the program.
Hi.
And from the studios of member station WMFE in Orlando, Ian McDonald, professor of biological oceanography at Florida State University. Professor McDonald studies the Gulf of Mexico's extreme deep ocean communities, including ecologies that form around natural hydrocarbon seeps. And nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Neil.
Richard Harris, why don't we start with you and a story you broke last Friday. What do we know about where some of that oil is now gone?
Well, that has been the big question, because clearly it's not washing up that much on the shores. It's not showing up in the beaches or the marshes so much anymore. But there's an unknown amount of oil still underwater. And what I reported on Friday was I talked to scientists actually out in the Gulf of Mexico who have been looking at oil on the bottom of the Gulf and actually finding a significant amount. They're still in the course of surveying it, but they found a layer of oily sediment about as much as 2 inches thick, or maybe even a little thicker in places, covering many, many, many square miles. They don't really know because the survey is still ongoing. But clearly some of the oil is gradually settling to the bottom.
And do they know that that oil is from the well?
They haven't done the chemical fingerprinting of it as yet, but it seems to be the only logical explanation for where that oil came from. The scientist I talked to, Samantha Joy, said that she's done hundreds and hundreds of core samples of the bottom of the Gulf over many, many years and has never seen anything like this. So pretty good indication.
And I think we have a follow-up question from here in the audience.
Gene is my name, and I'd like to find out if this oil turns out to be from the Deepwater Horizon, how is that going to complicate things?
How is that going to complicate things? And now that's a good question. Joel Bourne, you want to take a shot at that?
It's interesting because typically once the oil goes away on the surface, we tend to forget about it. And as Americans, we've done this on many spills in the past. But in this one case, this is the first big deep water spill. And so what we're really concerned about is the impact it's going to have, of course, on the species that we care about. We know the fisheries, the crabs, and everything else. Now, fingerprinting it to BP, I think, is going to be about 2 weeks away. The researchers I've talked to who've found similar oil on the bottom say, it's undoubtedly 100% sure BP well. I mean, we dumped 5.9 million barrels in the Gulf. It's going to go somewhere. And it seems to be precipitating out and coating fairly large parts of the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico.
Ian McDonald, let's turn to you. You study what happens with life on the floor. What's likely to happen if that life is covered by as much as 2 inches of oil?
Well, in short, the animals on the seafloor in the deep ocean will eat it. Those deep water animals have very little food. There's no light down there, and they depend on the rain of organic material from the surface. And so anything that falls to the bottom, the community of organisms down there is adapted to go and eat very quickly. So things like sea cucumbers and anemones and burrowing sea urchins, these organisms will crawl around and eat this stuff.
I might add, Neil, that actually what they're also seeing is that some of the sea life that is normally on the bottom is now under this layer. Some of those animals are dying, so it may have an immediate impact on the sea life down there. Again, it's not all 2 inches everywhere. Some of it's pretty thin, some of it's thicker, and so on. So I'm sure the circumstances depend upon how thick the layer is. But in the long run, it may get eaten. In the short run, it may be doing some damage as well.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask, we've heard so many different stories and heard so many different seemingly conflicting studies about what's happened to some of the oil, that it was in plumes in the water, that it was being eaten by microorganisms, or wasn't being eaten by microorganisms. Joel Bourne, can you bring us up to date?
Well, I think the research is ongoing. There are a lot of vessels out there, a lot of researchers that are trying to figure out this exact same question, because there have been some conflicting results. We had a Woods Hole study that said, you know, we're not seeing a lot of oxygen depletion, which means maybe it's not being eaten quite so fast. And then another study that says there's a lot of activity. So I think this is a fairly diffuse plume at this point. It's getting more and more scattered, and so it's getting a little more difficult to find. But, ultimately, oil is not something that's permanent. If it has oxygen, if it has nitrogen, it will be degraded. What the real risk is if it does get buried in these sediments, and there's very low oxygen for the bacteria to use to eat it up, and then it can persist for decades. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real concern.
We've all learned that there are different constituent parts of oil used for many industrial purposes as they're fractioned out. But, Richard, some of these are very light and evaporate quickly. Others do not.
That's right. And at least on the oil that came directly to the surface, a significant portion of that did evaporate and it went into the air and is at least no longer a concern for as water pollution. One of the big unknowns here is how much of the oil actually did come up to the surface and how much just actually stayed under layers of cold and dense water. It's sort of atomized like a spray can, and droplets that small may not have ever come to the surface. In fact, probably a significant amount of the oil didn't, although, again, that's a subject of research, and there are big unknowns around that. So it sort of depends how much got up, how much evaporated.
Ian McDonald, another question for you. Another thing we heard about, we're really worried about at various points, that the oil would get into the loop current and be pulled through the Straits of Florida on up the East Coast. Did any of that happen?
It did for a little while. The loop current varies in its pathway through the Gulf. Sometimes it goes far north, almost as far as the Mississippi Delta, and other times it's further to the south. So in the beginning of the spill, along about May, there was a filament of the surface slick that was being drawn into the loop current. But then, fortunately, the loop current migrated further to the south, and that transport came to an end. So the scenario that everybody was worried about oil being carried around Florida, fortunately did not come to pass.
Let me reintroduce Ian McDonald, professor of oceanography at Florida State University, is taking a time out from attending the conference at the Florida Oil Spill Academic Task Force. Joel Bourne, also with us here on stage at the Grosvenor Auditorium. He's the environmental reporter and the author of the cover story in this month's issue of National Geographic on the spill, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. If you'd like to join the conversation, what worries you about the environmental impact of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Let's see if we can go to Brian. Brian with us from St. Louis.
Yes, I have a question. I've been hearing a lot about what this is doing to our economy, what this is doing to our fisheries and so forth, but I think there's a bigger issue at stake here, and that's the Caribbean nations and the Mexico that depend, a large part of their economy is based upon tourism. And if we kill off all the undersea life and the corals that are going to be affected by this and the dispersant, what's going to happen to them?
Joel Bourne, can you help us out on that?
Has there been any plan for that?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, so far we haven't seen much impact on reefs. There are studies going on to look at deep water reefs. The previous big oil spill, Ixtoc, that happened in 79, did severe damage to many reefs in the southern part of Mexico. But fortunately, in this particular case, the reefs didn't get heavily oiled. And so and the oil sort of stayed in the northern Gulf and what's left of it.
It would not have gone to Mexico.
It would not have, if not had gone that far south. No.
And the islands are south and east of the site of this well. Right. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for the call.
Is that taking into account the undercurrents? Because I know that on the surface it runs directionally, but on the underflow, doesn't it travel further south from the U.S. toward the Caribbean nations?
Well, again, the scientists are really looking at about 100-square-mile area around the Macondo well site. So, and that's kind of where they think the most of it will end up.
All right, Brian, thanks very much. We have a question here from the audience.
Yes, hi. My question is about the benchmarks, first of all, that are being used against which to measure the extent of the damage, and beyond 100 miles, by the way. In other words, primary, secondary, tertiary damage. And in conjunction with that question, what are the milestones to measure progress over, again, the short term and the longer term? In other words, how much do we know about, the snapshot of what's been going on there, in the Gulf, in a far future, far past or distant past?
Ian McDonald?
Thank you.
Excellent question. This unfortunate event has been widely described as an experiment, an experiment we didn't want to do. And at this point, the patient has been given the drug, the treatment, and we don't see it anymore. He's swallowed it. The Gulf of Mexico has taken this oil mostly in, and we can't see it. And now we're waiting to see what happens. And the concept of benchmarks is exactly right, because there were near-term effects, and we all felt them emotionally as well as in the response effort. The dead birds and the turtles that washed up were deeply wrenching to everyone, I think. But in the long term, we have to see what happens to the populations of critical animals that make up the healthy Gulf of Mexico ecosystem. I'm talking about species like sperm whales, bluefin tuna, loggerhead tuna, and then more humble animals like the menhaden, the periwinkles. Those are the things that we have to track over time, I believe.
Stay with us. More on that when we come back. We're at the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C., talking about the state of the Gulf, its unique ecosystem, and the effects of the oil spill. What do you want to know about the oil? What worries you about its impact on the environment? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan at the headquarters of the National Geographic in Washington, D.C. Nearly 5 months after BP's Macondo well exploded and began gushing oil into the Gulf, workers may now be days away from permanently sealing it. The Coast Guard said yesterday the relief well should intersect the blown-out well in the next 24 hours. Then BP will pump in concrete and kill it. We also learned yesterday the Interior Department ordered companies with inactive wells in the Gulf to seal those. It's an effort to avoid future spills that may contaminate Gulf waters. Today we're talking about the state of the Gulf after the leak. We're getting a better understanding of the damage that was and was not done. For more information about the oil spill and its impact, turn to the October edition of National Geographic magazine or tune into Explorer, Can the Gulf Survive? On Tuesday, September 28th on the National Geographic channel. And we want to hear from you what you want to know about the oil and what worries you about its impact on the environment. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We're also taking questions from the audience here in the Grosvenor Auditorium. Our guests, Richard Harris, NPR senior science correspondent, Ian McDonald, professor of oceanography at Florida State University, an expert on deep water ecology, and Joel Bourne, who reports on the environment and contributes to National Geographic magazine, including that terrific cover story this month. I wanted to go back, Ian McDonald, to you. You were just talking about what we need to watch are these species, tuna, periwinkle. How do those population levels, what did that tell us about what's happening in the Gulf?
Well, the benchmark for a healthy ecosystem is the continued survival of animals that depend on a healthy ecosystem. That's the great lesson of the Endangered Species Act. We know that we can preserve habitats and ecosystems if the benchmark species continue to exist in them. So I use the example of whales, sperm whales. The Gulf of Mexico has a resident population of somewhere between 1,400 and 1,660 sperm whales. That was before the discharge. And that population was right on the edge of either increasing or decreasing. And what we need to do is we need to watch that population very closely, because there is a possibility that it could get tipped over, that could lose enough individuals so that it goes into a decline from which it can't recover. So that sort of study is very important. The difficulty with that study is it does not fit neatly into the rubric of the National Resource Damage Assessment Process, which NOAA is now conducting. And that process depends more on dead animals with oil in their stomach that can be offered as evidence in court. So somewhere a balance has to be found between the legal process and the scientific process.
And no, of course, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, not a fellow with an arc. And he only gets them 2x2. Let's go to a question here in the audience.
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm from Washington, D.C. And I'm just wondering what we know at this point about the effect of the chemical dispersants, what that has had on life in the Gulf so far.
Anybody want to take a shot at that?
Sure,
Richard?
I'll take a little shot. I think it's there's some question about that for sure. What we do know is the dispersant is toxic, but it's probably less toxic than the oil that's out there. So the dispersant had the effect of probably some toxic effects immediately, but also its more important effect was keeping a lot of the oil from getting to the surface and washing ashore. When people talk about the biggest concern and biggest damage from oil spills, it's always about the oil that's going into the marshes and so on that is really the very most fragile ecosystem. So you could argue that the dispersants actually, even though they were toxic in and of themselves, they did reduce the amount of damage to the marshes and so on. But the flip side of that is that the dispersants almost certainly helped keep the oil underwater for better or worse. And that's why one reason we're having so much trouble really understanding the full impact of the spill is because there's an unknown amount of oil that's still underwater, and understanding that impact is actually in some ways more difficult than being able to wade through the marshes and saying, oh, there's a dead marsh, there's a dead marsh. Mm-hmm. Makes it a tougher question.
Yeah. Let's see if we go to a caller. Let's go to Jay. Jay with us from San Jose.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. There's something I haven't understood about this from the beginning. There are thousands of production oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico, and the companies that own them know with great accuracy exactly how much oil to the barrel is coming out of each well. They know that. This well hadn't gone into production yet. Why were the estimates throughout the whole thing wildly off by factors of 10 and 20 sometimes? Why did they never know or tell us how much oil was even coming out?
Well,
that's an excellent question.
Richard, you were on our program at various points saying, no, they've revised the estimate.
Right, and I must say that I was encouraged to dig into this by Ian MacDonald, who very early on in the process was looking at the amount of oil on the surface and saying, this is not adding up to the official numbers. And Ian got me to dig much more deeply into this. And yes, I do not understand why the authorities, either the federal government or BP, didn't actually make some serious effort to measure the amount of oil coming out of its well, because there were beautiful videos that actually provided some very compelling information about how much oil was coming out. BP had a sense of the pressure. They were able to tell Congress what sort of the maximum possible outflow was. So they knew that they had some sense of how the potential of this well. They just didn't know because of how much blockage was in the well, kinks in the pipes. They were unwilling to say this is how much is coming out, and maybe for legal reasons as well, because their fines may depend upon how much oil spewed out of the well.
I was going to say they seemed to be reluctant to give us a worst-case scenario.
Right, but the federal government also, which was overseeing the response to the spill, also didn't seem to take this question very seriously until we pressed pretty hard and said, hey, are 1,000 barrels a day, 5,000 barrels a day, those seem unbelievably low.
Mm-hmm. Ian MacDonald, you were also on this program very early on. Richard was busy. And so we talked to you. But that was just in the first few days after this started. I wonder, what surprised you that you've learned in the 4.5 months since?
Well, it's fascinating that BP issued two separate studies in which they estimated how much oil was coming out, and they were joined in that effort by NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. The study that they did based on remote sensing gave its best guess estimate 5,700 barrels per day. Shortly after that, they did a study based on the reservoir and the reservoir pressures and what they knew about the plumbing. And there they estimated a range of release between 5,000 and a worst case of 60,000 barrels a day. And in that report, that second report, they said, well, it couldn't possibly be 60,000 barrels a day because the remote sensing effort says that it's only 5,000 barrels a day. And so I think they got themselves, with whatever additional legal concerns, into a sort of a circular reasoning, because it turns out that that 60,000 barrels a day, their worst-case scenario, is very close to what the flow rate technical group finally concluded that the actual flow rate was at the beginning of the calamity.
Here's an email question from Kim in Fort Myers about the enormous fish kill reported this morning on the news. If this was a normal occurrence, how is it that I've never heard of it before? The fish kill looked like something of biblical proportions. And I don't know, Joel, have you been keeping up with this?
Following in a little bit. And, yeah, unfortunately, fish kills are fairly common in the summer in coastal Louisiana. Even in coastal North Carolina, where I live, we have them. And there are low oxygen events that are a function of heat and, activity that chews up the oil. So the early reports on this is that probably not a factor from the oil spill.
Low oxygen areas, the dead zones that we're hearing about?
These are the dead zones. And, of course, the Gulf of Mexico has a famous one that this summer was the size of Massachusetts. And this is from fertilizer and sewage coming down the Mississippi River. It's been noted, I think, since the mid-'80s. And it's a tremendous area. And that, of course, is one of great concern. But, again, a contributing factor that makes the Gulf not as resilient as it possibly once was.
Well, let's get a question from here in the audience.
Thank you. I've been appreciating the conversation. And we've talked, you all have talked a lot about the confusion that's coming out of the fast-evolving science. And I'm curious as to what have journalists and scientists learned from this experience where we've had very fast-evolving science and the ability to communicate that change as well as the concept of uncertainty.
Ian McDonald, we'll put that to you.
It's been remarkable in this, watching the flow of events and, you know, in the thick of it when we were really trying to figure out what was going on. There was a great exchange between journalists and scientists. Some of it perhaps created some sensation, but I think all of it ultimately was positive in moving the truth forward. I know I had many conversations with Richard and also Justin Gillis from the New York Times, and they were very helpful in digging things out and telling me, you know, about different aspects of the ongoing event. So I think that between the scientists and the journalists, we did get a lot of the truth out, and I'm proud of that community for that effort.
Ian McDonald, we've heard concerns that some of the scientific studies that are going to be conducted into the future are being paid for by BP, and that the results of this are going to be proprietary and not necessarily shared or shared in a timely manner. What's going on there at the Florida Oil Spill Academic Task Force?
Well, the money is coming from BP, but there is no restriction on publication, or none of this is going to end up in court. And all of the people that I was with yesterday and today are determined as quickly as possible to publish. And we have studies looking at organisms from sponges to sharks, looking at the food chain, both in the bottom of the ocean and also on the extreme layer, the very thin layer called the nouston, the very surface of the ocean. There's geochemists and modelers, and there's a broad-scale effort within Florida, and it's being replicated to some extent also in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, to investigate this scientifically and to publish the results scientifically. So I think that the money from BP is being well spent, and it's being dispersed rapidly here in Florida to the effect of getting the studies going.
Joel Bourne, I know you've been talking to a lot of scientists on this point, too.
Yes, and you know, BP originally promised $500 million, I think, for long-term studies. And this is one of the weaknesses of our past oil spills. You know, as soon as we don't see the oil, we forget about it, and the funding for research and long-term impacts just dries up. And many of the researchers, like Professor McDonald, are determined not to let that happen this time. BP has released about $40 million so far to get these early studies up and running. A lot of scientists are questioning, you know, sort of where the rest of it's going to come from and when it's going to come. And BP, when I called them, they're like, well, it's complicated.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. So,
yeah, I would add, I think it's an excellent question about It's not business as usual for science journalism at all. We normally like to wait till things are published and that I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and so on. And here's an instance where the facts are moving very quickly and we have to use sort of a different ruler. I do sort of a lot of informal peer review, calling people I know in the field and saying, does this sound right to you? And doing a lot of cross-checking and so on. Some stuff by now has reached the published literature and has actually been peer reviewed, but it's not always the case. But I think that there's a case to be made that things are moving so quickly and that we need to know as quickly as we can that I report when I can, and I make sure that to the extent that I can, I put in the unknown, you know, mention what's known and what's not known. I think that's always an important element of these reporting about this stuff.
Richard is actually very impetuous. It's his editors who want him to check things. Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent with us here at the Grosvenor Auditorium, along with Joel Bourne, a veteran environmental reporter and contributing writer to National Geographic magazine, with us on the line from member station WMFE in Orlando is Ian McDonald, professor of oceanography at Florida State University. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation coming to you from NPR News. And let's see, we go to another caller. This is Steve. Steve with us from Wichita.
Hello. I'm an engineer. Not that I'm an oil engineer. In Kansas, the uncertainty, as you and Ian have discussed, is great right now, and you can't know the effects. But the root cause is that the oil did escape. While we can't prevent, you know, reasonably, we know accidents happening in the future, they're going to happen, no matter what better prevention devices we use or fixing the ones that we have presently, accidents are going to unfortunately happen. And so the oil needs to be captured at the source as it's leaking or soon after it starts to leak, perhaps with some kind of umbrella-like device that funnels the leak to the surface and is anchored to the bottom. And I wanted to not supplant the present discussion, which is valuable too, but to advocate that we work on some way to capture the oil at the source as it's leaking, and then it should logically be a oil company expense of doing business here, although controlled by the government for the public good. And can you guys discuss that?
Okay. We heard ideas from everything from the umbrella-like device that he suggested to nuclear weapons. So, Joel Bourne, can you help us?
Yeah, I think your callers hit on the key point, because we basically ran off the edge of the continental shelf before we had all these things in place, much to the chagrin of everyone. And to not have, double blind sure rams on your blowout preventer that won't hit the tool joint, so you can actually make it work, to have backup systems to actually engage the thing, to have something that will collect oil in the midwater, if you do have a deep sea blowout. All these things have been discussed. Many of them have been used, although the midwater thing is something that they're still trying to develop. But certainly there are many more safety precautions that are used elsewhere in the world, Norway specifically, that we could certainly integrate here, because really it is prevention. Mm-hmm. And because so much more of our deep water oil resources, lie over 5,000 feet, 10,000 feet, there's just this compelling drive to get there.
Richard, I know that the companies have committed a lot of money to developing these kinds of technologies, but is this just lots of booms and vacuum cleaners?
No, I think some of the technology that was developed for this disaster will be warehoused as is, or maybe replicated and so on, so that there will be these tools will be at ready disposal. However, I will note many of these wonderful ideas, including the umbrellas and various ways of conveying oil to the surface early on, would actually not have been successful in this case, even if you could have gotten oil to the surface, because they were, as you recall, way underestimating how much oil was coming out. And they would not have been, they could have gotten it to the surface, but they had no way of handling it at the surface because they had so dramatically underestimated how much oil was coming out of the well. So you not only need technology, you need to also have better knowledge about what you're dealing with.
Here's an email question from Stephen in Scandia, Minnesota. Several species, clams, crabs, mussels, have larval forms that go to sea and then return to the coast to become adults. I'm concerned about the effect of the spill on the larval pelagic stages of these species. How many are returning the coast to become adults? Ian McDonald, a quick answer if that's possible.
Well, that's what everybody's worried about, is the larval species that took such a long dose. I mean, 84, 85 days of oil being put out exactly in the place where so many larval species are spawned, the bluefin tuna, you know, many of these crabs, larvae. And I guess there have been reports of larvae that had spots of oil already incorporated into their bodies. There are sampling programs going on to collect the plankton and see if we can assess the damage. But really, we're not going to know until we track the populations over time just how many year classes are affected by this event.
Year classes, the number of animals born each year, a generation, if you will. More in a moment about the state of the Gulf after the oil spill. We're also going to mark a terrible human tragedy. Remember the 11 people who died when the Deepwater Horizon exploded. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, our focus is on the Gulf of Mexico. After the spill, we want to hear what you want to know about the oil and what worries you about the impact on the environment. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We've also posted at that site a slideshow of images from National Geographic showing the aftermath of the spill. We're going to take questions from the audience here in the Grosvenor Auditorium as well. Let me reintroduce our guests, Richard Harris, NPR senior science correspondent, Ian McDonald, professor of oceanography at Florida State and an expert on deep water ecology, and Joel Bourne, who reports on the environment and contributes to National Geographic magazine and the principal author of this week's cover story on the oil spill. Let's get a question from here in the audience.
I'm T.J. Mullen from Baltimore, Maryland, and I have a small company that develops technology to help water pollution, particularly stormwater runoff, and I'm also on a board of the Baltimore Water Alliance, which deals with clean water around Baltimore. You always hear about technology scaling up. I'm curious if there are any emerging technologies that we may be able to scale down to look at, you know, collecting oil from the Gulf, especially sheen on the surface and dissolved particulates that are not dispersant-oriented, that we could apply maybe to urban infrastructure and deal with oil and hydrocarbon problems that we have right in our own backyard.
Yeah, it's a very provocative idea. Do you have any ideas? I mean, I haven't heard of any such thing.
Our phone started ringing when the spill happened, and we were like, well, you know, this is a little bit out of our out of the scale of what we do. But we're going to follow it very closely, and you know, if we have any ideas, we'll be sure to let you know. But
okay. Thanks very much for the question. Here's an email question from Ryan in Grand Blanc, Michigan. As I've listened to the story, I can't help but wonder how experts can make any accurate predictions about the environmental ecological impact of oil, considering our extremely limited knowledge of deep ocean ecology. Ian McDonald, is your knowledge extremely limited?
Well, it's not as extensive as it should be, that's for certain. And in fact, the region of the Gulf, this below 5,000 foot depth level, we know less there about the life there than we do about life at shallower depths, because the industry has only begun to expand into that region. But we do know that this is a very sensitive realm, very sensitive organisms, and that they are not adapted to change. Things aren't supposed to happen. They're not supposed to get sudden influxes of toxic chemicals, and they're not supposed to get sudden effects like that. And so the populations may be grievously affected by this. I said earlier that I thought that a lot of the oil would be consumed by sea cucumbers and other bottom-dwelling organisms. I don't think that is going to do them any good at all. We're pretty certain that there's going to be some ill effects of that. But what happens if you kill a million sea cucumbers to the deep Gulf ecosystem is not at all clear, and that's the sort of thing that no study really can prepare us for, and that we're going to have to learn from this as best we can.
Just a quick follow-up question on that from Janine, in Alexander, Arkansas. As a biologist, it's news to me that animals such as anemones and urchins can eat oil. Could you elaborate?
Well, they eat any kind of organic material that falls to the seafloor, and one of their foods is something called marine snow, which is a sort of a flocculate particle of fluffy-like stuff that settles down. And certain times of the year, there's a big fall of this marine snow, and these organisms go around very quickly and eat it up. And that's been documented by time-lapse cameras and so forth. So what Samantha Joy and others are describing, this sort of flocculated oil, sounds very like that sort of a substance. And I think that these organisms don't have a sense of taste, and I think they're going to end up ingesting a lot of it. It's not going to be good for them.
I don't think we've ever used the word flocculate on the program before. Joel Bourne, I wanted to turn to you and ask what we have learned from history. I know that's part of the work you did and previous spills, very large spills in the Gulf of Mexico, and people look at that and say, well, recovered from that, didn't it?
Right. It just took time. And here's the thing that I think we forget, that we've been spilling oil basically since we've been drilling for it. And we know quite a lot about the impacts of oil spills, not as much as we'd like, but like the Amoco Cadiz spill in 79.
That's off the coast of France.
Off the coast of France. You know, it took about 7 years for that. They have a large oyster and mussel industry on the tidal flats and estuaries and on the Breton coast. It took them 7 years to recover. I interviewed some fishermen down in Veracruz after the, you know, who were fishing, you know, men in their 60s who remember the Ixtoc spill. And they said it took 15 to 20 years for their catches to come back. Now, other research says the shrimp fishery in the Bay of Campeche came back fairly quickly. So it just depends on where you are and what you're trying to catch. But the long-term impacts of these things are significant, subtle at times, but significant. And again, you know, the Exxon Valdez was another example. They lost a herring fishery that many people think was probably from the Valdez.
Ian McDonald, also, are the effects cumulative after a big spill in 79, another big spill this year, all the seepage that we know occurs naturally?
Well, this shouldn't be compared to the natural seepage. This is so much larger, you know, thousands of times greater and much more concentrated in space and time than the natural seeps. The natural seeps are a good way of comparing, however, what happens when you soak a lot of oil into the seafloor. And one of the things that happens is that the regular burrowing organisms that are common throughout the rest of the Gulf don't occur around natural seeps. So there is an effect that restructures the ecosystem. And the long-term effects, I mean, the Prince William Sound does give us, although it's a very different environment, does give us a lot of points of comparison. And the herring fishery that Joel was talking about, they opened the fishery up after they finished the response effort, and they had one good year. The catches were pretty good, and then the next year the population crashed. And so we have to be very careful not to, you know, to say that it's all over before it's over. There were pods of orcas, the killer whales, and one of the pods completely disappeared. They never found any dead animals, but the pod just was not there. So my big concern ecologically is for a reduction in the productivity and the biodiversity of the whole ecosystem that persists for some time. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, 10 years of 10% less adds up to a whole lot less for everybody.
Let me ask you all a question about what answers you're looking for in the future. What questions should we be answering, looking to ask in the coming days and months? Joel Bourne, what are you going to be looking at?
Well, I'm really curious about what the regulatory response is going to be. Like, if we say we're not getting off oil anytime soon and we're going to go after these resources, how are we going to regulate the industry in a way to make sure that this type of thing either does not happen again, or the likelihood of it is very small, or even if it happens, you know, we can deal with it. So far, I've heard very little about what's coming out, and I know they're working on new rigs, but, you know, a better blowout preventer here, something else there. I mean, what I think we really need to do is change the culture of how we regulate this industry and come up with a much better and safer way to do it.
We are seeing some of that happening now, indeed. The agency that overlooked this has been dismantled and separated out into different agencies, so that the same agency that is responsible for the income, and this is the second largest source of government income after the IRS, that those people are not the same people in charge of saying, wait a minute, we're not sure you're proceeding safely here.
That's right, and I think that's going to be key. After every major oil disaster, we've seen some sort of policy advance on this to try to prevent it. And I'm very curious to see what's going to come up with it in a time of staggering deficits when we, you know, the coffers of Congress really need filling. Whether they're going to be willing to touch this industry is something I'm very interested in.
Ian McDonald, what questions are you going to be asking in the months and weeks ahead?
Well, I want to know how we're going to respond in terms of how we take care of the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, if you look at the notes and the budget issued by NOAA, they said that about 10% of the oil was removed by the response effort, and all of the rest of it was taken care of by Mother Nature. And how are we going to repay Mother Nature? We've heard a lot about restitution to fishermen and hotel owners, but somewhere in this process, we need to put Mother Nature first in line for repayment. Fortunately, there is a mechanism for that, which is the gigantic fine that BP is going to get levied. And I want to see what happens to that fine. My feeling is that we should create a permanent endowment to restore, to understand, and sustain the Gulf of Mexico ecosystem for future generations. And I want to see if we develop the will and the political consciousness and environmental consciousness to do that as a lesson from this calamity.
Richard Harris, let me turn to you. What questions are you going to be asking?
Well, those are both really good questions. And I think my duty to my listeners, I think, is to try to go back to the questions that I've been so far been able to say, I don't know, we don't know, and go back and keep going back to those questions and getting better answers for what, how much oil is actually under the Gulf, what is it actually doing to the wildlife down there, and understanding more about, you know, all of those things that have question marks.
Richard Harris, thank you very much for being with us today. Richard Harris is NPR's senior science correspondent and joined us here in the Grosvenor Auditorium. We'd also like to thank Joel Bourne, a veteran environmental reporter, contributing writer to National Geographic, and author of the cover story in this month's issue of the magazine On the Spill. Thank you, sir. And thanks as well to Ian McDonald, professor of oceanography at Florida State University and expert on deep water ecology. We thank him for taking time out, attending the conference on the Florida Oil Spill Academic Task Force. And he joined us from the studios of our member station in Orlando, WMFE. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News.